All right, so next up to speak to you is John Iles, and he's also here from the UK, from Gloucestershire, and he is part of the Guild of St. George as well. He runs all of the projects. The Guild owns some land in the Wyre Forest, and he runs the projects there in the forest and liaises with the Forestry Commission, and he's involved with the Wyre Forest Land Trust. So he's actually, I've been talking about Ruskin and the natural world. He's going to tell you now a little bit about what Ruskin's organization, the Guild of St. George, is still doing and the plans that we have for the future dealing with nature and the natural world, okay, the actual practical applications.
Thank you, and what a tremendous welcome. And just really want to say a big thank you for inviting us here today. My wife Linda in the front row here and I are sort of touring down the west coast of this huge country of yours. And we end up here on May the 31st in this amazing building to talk about stuff back in England. It's just all a bit bizarre. But also, as another sort of example of this whole interconnectedness of this world that we live in, that we can sort of email backs and forths to Sarah about arrangements for all of this, is that there's an institution in California, I'm trying to find out which one it is, that's actually funding our son's doctorate studies that he's doing in Oxford, you know? So how does that... I want to pop in and say thank you to them for keeping our son off the streets for another 3 years. So, yeah, some fantastic stuff going on. And I've enjoyed tremendously what I've heard so far. I've got massive intellectual indigestion of all these words. So most of my talk is about pictures and doing things. But I couldn't not acknowledge what you have here. And the last 3 days, Linda and I have spent worshipping in this fantastic cathedral of Yosemite. And picking up a book on John Muir and his time in Yosemite. And I think one of his quotes in here is relevant for today, that everyone needs beauty as well as bread, places to pray in and places to pray in, where nature may heal and cheer and give strength to body and soul alike. And I sort of felt, Sarah, where you left us was that our issues are as much to do with our hearts and our heads as our sort of apparent ways of being able to sort of break everything down scientifically. And perhaps something of what we're trying to do in our little bit of England is something around heart and head and hands together as to how we might move forward. So this is us. This is my beloved. Linda's the taller one without the beard. And this is Uncliss Farm in the middle of Worcestershire. You'll see surrounded by trees. We live in the middle of a huge forest called the Wyre Forest. So Uncliss Farm, built out of stone, back to the architecture talk this morning. The stones on the right-hand side of the building are much smaller and badly formed. They're the stones that were just picked out the ground and made a house with. The extension on the left, which was built in 1914, that's the bit left of the chimney, those were quarried, so those stones are dressed and more regular. So what you're going to get this afternoon is a bit of a whistle-stop tour, a little bit of background on Ruskin and his followers in Bewdley, and then what I call the unfolding story of what we're in the midst of over in Worcestershire. And I hope that some of you who have become companions of the Guild of St. George will journey with us over the years and perhaps see what us and our successors do. It's kind of waking up a bit of a sleeping giant, which I'm sure Clive will touch on a little bit later on, in that the Guild almost sort of packed up 20, 30 years ago, but now seems to be really re-energised, and we're both incredibly proud to be here with Jim and others, sort of bringing this all to life over here. So for those of you who aren't so good on the geography thing, this is where we are. Most people come to London, they might go to Stratford, they might make it to York, but we're over in the middle, a bit next to Birmingham. And just up the river for us, we live on the River Severn, is the Iron Bridge and the Colebrookdale, the pictures that Sarah showed you a little bit further earlier on. the cradle of the Industrial Revolution. And this forest that we're in, you can see in the bottom this place called Unkliss, in the middle of this thing called the Wyre Forest. This forest was an industrialized landscape. None of our trees are what you would call here old growth. They have all been managed through a process called coppicing. You chop them down and the oak trees grow again for two products in the last 200 years. One was for charcoal to smelt things, and the other was the bark for tanning, for leather. So our challenges are now sort of rather different, which is how to manage that forest for the future. Bewdley is an old 17th century river town, and the forest was its sustainable supply of energy and fuel and timber for building. We've touched on this a little bit during the course of the day, but the Guild of St. George, formed by George Baker, a Birmingham businessman, who's got the phone on, and John Ruskin. It was all inspired by Ruskin's writings in Fours. And George Baker gave Ruskin some land in the forest in the 1870s, which was then cleared of the trees and planted as an orchard in 1880 by a gentleman by the name of William Graham. Now, I think one or two of the speakers today have touched on the things. There's not always everything that you read about Ruskin is fantastically good. And in fact, some of the things we've just started, Mark Frost, who Sarah quoted from, is doing some research on some letters between William Graham and Ruskin that he's found in a library in Massachusetts. Well, it turns out Ruskin was not a very nice man at times to William Graham, having persuaded him to give up his job as a calligrapher, come to Wyre, plant the orchard, and William Graham is writing time after time saying, "Where's the money that you promised me, you bastard?" You know, it didn't quite get that bit, but we'll see what Mark... The first chapter of the book's out. I think the rest will be out later in the day. But there was a number of followers who moved from Liverpool. Amongst those were the Quails, who settled at Unkliss, which is where we live, and they planted cherry orchards. Ruskin describes, you know, some of the things he wants to achieve, and this is something that we're really taking hold of as our sort of mission statement, if you like, is to try and make some small piece of English ground beautiful, peaceful, and fruitful. And in our work, we're trying really hard to press on that word fruitfulness, and what does that mean, both in terms of producing fruit from cherry trees, oak from timber, but the fruitfulness of spirit, the fruitfulness of human endeavour, what does that look like? We also hang on hard to this statement, and Clive commissioned a beautiful slate for us that says, "There is no wealth but life." You know, and at times when you think, yes, that really, we've got to hang on to that. The Guild's objectives are really around threefold things: the rural economy, craftsmanship, and appreciation of the art. So we're trying to bring all that together in this little bit of Worcestershire. And through that, there's a process that we've gone through of a partnership. I won't go through all this in detail, but Clive has been really, really important to have someone who's not an environmentalist or a conservationist or a government agency person helping us to create a vision for the forest. So let's just get into some of the practical stuff. So first of all, where are we? There's the big splodge of greenery. A big chunk of that is oak trees. A lot of it is Douglas, planted after the First World War. Ruskin land sits there right in the middle. We're about 20 miles southwest of Birmingham. The River Severn, you can see on the right-hand side of your picture there. So these are the properties that the Guild owns. St. George's Farm, a building, lovely brick building. You can see the bottom left of the picture there. The bricks actually made with clay dug on site and fired with timber from the forest. Unkliss Farm, probably an older building. We think something's been on the site since about 1650. And quarried stone. Next to that is this building, which you'll see some more pictures of in a moment, the Ruskin Studio, which we've created. And then there's this little bungalow that was built in the 1930s. And all around us is this area of 100 acres of oak forest. Now, interestingly, as we all stand and give these talks and tell tales, different people come out of the woodwork and say, ah, but yes, and here's some more bits of the jigsaw to put together. So this is some photos that I got only a couple of weeks before we set off from Derek Davis, who's the grandson of the first family to live at St. George's Farm, Fred and Ada Watson. And so here's, we've got some of the quails on the left-hand side of the picture. Fred Watson is the rather angry-looking man on the right. But interestingly, this is taken apparently at Uncliffe Farm, and we look in the background and we see the sort of size of the oak trees. And what I want to delve into, not in this talk, but with Mark Frost and others who are doing the research, is what was the motivation of these people to give up life in Liverpool to come and live in the middle of a forest where there was only a very muddy track to get to any town? How did they live together? What was the sense of community there? What were their endeavours beyond survival? This is St. George's Farm with the Watsons stood in front of it. Derek's mother is Eva, is the lass on the left there. It's rather a fine building. This is Fred and Ada. We think probably on a Sunday. He's probably reading the Bible or some other sort of piece of literature in his Sunday best. This is him off to market with Ada with chickens in the back of the cart there. And this is Derek's mum, Eva, in the pasture with the pigs in the orchard. And what I find interesting now, we're sort of turned farmers, is some of these trees they haven't looked after too well. There's a dead one right in front of the pigs there. They've obviously had to protect the trees from browsing, perhaps by the deer, but also by the pigs, and the sort of size that the cherry trees are at this time. Along the lane, a sign saying, right of way for all purposes, St. George's, Ruskin Land, fruit and poultry farm, honey for sale, no business on Sundays. So quite a strong ethic there. All around us, the area is noted for its orchards, and particularly cherry trees. And so here, some folks gathering in the hay, as well as collecting the cherries. Now, the word is that the cherries were collected by women up the ladders. The men's job was to move the ladders, which was, I thought, very noble of them. And so we've actually been left with a legacy of these fantastic cherry trees. They're rubbish in terms of fruit, because we have health and safety regulations now that make it a bit tricky to shove women up long ladders. And also the orchards were, the fruit was protected from the birds collecting it, because the birds do a much better job picking fruit than we do, by lots of children banging dustbin lids and making a noise, firing guns at them and all the rest of it. And sadly, now we've got legislation that means that children have to go to school rather than bashing dustbin lids in orchards. So quite a challenge in terms of producing crops. But crops they did produce, and some of the orchards, there's one of our orchards right next to us on Cedric Quayle's land. He's got records that show that in 1936, that orchard produced 750 pounds worth of fruit. Now, if you do the sums, that works out about 22 to 25,000 pounds times 0.6 to dollars, so whatever, a lot of money. So it was well worth you protecting your crop, because you got a tremendous value for it. As we drive across the plains of California, we see thousands of acres, square miles of cherry trees, which is why we can't sell our cherries for love nor money, really. And likewise in Chile and Hungary and all sorts of other places. We have a railway station, and the cherries were taken to our nearest big city, Birmingham, in those baskets on the right there. So it meant that the cherries could be picked fresh that afternoon, down to the station, boom, into the market, and distributed the next morning. It's called logistics now. In the old days, it was a train. And it means that we can probably fly them in from Chile cheaper and faster than we can get them from the wire forest. Here's our farm, but I don't want this to be a sort of journey into nostalgia and all the rest of it. In the 1950s, and you can see all the cherry trees around the farm, and then the wider forest around it. So let's go a bit further into that. So this is the orchard as it is now. Part of really what we're about there, both Linda and myself have spent most of our lives in the conservation world, engaging people in that activity. We're not environmentalists who sit and write about stuff. We sort of try and get people actually doing it and believe that their own sort of personal conversion comes through the planting of the trees or the collecting of the hay or whatever. So what we've been trying to do is to sort of live by some sort of an example in today's context. So we try and respect the natural world, that the farm provides meaningful work, produces quality food, that we believe very much in encouraging creativity and reflection and developing skills and abilities, that, you know, these things are really important. Hands can do things. So, So we produce our electricity from the sun. Only last November did we get connected to the electricity grid, thanks to the Guild's investment. The romance of living off-grid for 9 years and padding out in my pyjamas at 6 o'clock in the morning to turn the generator on in darkest December really did wear off. We heat the place with wood, because we've got plenty of that around, and we've put in underfloor heating, and the wood fire stove, Linda can make a fantastic pudding out of that. So in terms of practical things, we've restored the traditional orchard, and as you'll see in a few minutes, done a lot of work about restoring hay meadows. So it's almost, I don't know if this reflects the law of health thing, but it's the three connected circles of land, people and other resources that we can pull together. And we've done that through a thing called the Community Land Trust. And I was very fortunate 20 odd years ago, I had a Winston Churchill travelling fellowship and came over more to the east coast of the US to Massachusetts and Pennsylvania to look at the work of land trusts and public sector, private sector partnerships there. But all around us are these fantastic wildflower meadows. And I just love the language that we've used in the 20th and early 21st century. These are what are called non-improved meadows. Okay? Now, see how you get this. I mean, Jim had a big thing about people not being able to spell right. I think we can't even use our words right. This is non-improved. Improved in this sense means it's worse, in that to improve a meadow, what you do is you plough it. So you might even just spray it all. Thank you, Monsanto. With Roundup, that's why they all go brown. You spray it all, you plough it, you reseed it with ryegrass usually, and then you have to put fertilizer on it, which is nitrates, which comes from natural gas, which you're now going to frack the world for. And you end up with something that's so much better. It is better in the sense that it produces a lot more mass of grass, but I would advocate, and there are others that will, I think, you know, back this up, that cattle fed on this stuff are much healthier than cattle fed on a monoculture. And it's a bit like if we ate a certain brand of burgers all the time, we wouldn't be too healthy. We see in our cattle that they actually sort of choose to eat different plants. If they've only got ryegrass, that's all they got. Anyway, rant over. We share the world around us with these lovely fellows, the fallow deer. And this is our main piece of equipment for maintaining unimproved meadows. They're called cows, and they eat grass. And these are a breed called Dexter cattle, come from the west coast of Ireland. They're very hardy. They're small, which means it doesn't hurt too much when they tread on my feet. They breed very easily, and they can be out all year round. And they taste fantastic at the end of the process as well. So, and that's the tough bit, actually. You know, it's quite easy to make a bit of a joke of it, but that the cattle, there is a cycle to go through, and certain things have to die in that process. But by doing so, we started off in this little farm in the middle of the wire forest, and then gradually other wildflower meadows have come to our notice that we've been asked to look after, And so this is rather spread like the plague, really. So where we started off just running a little farm of 13 acres, we now manage 350 acres, mostly of other people's land. So it's actually quite a complex operation to run, because those cows can only be on those fields for a certain little length of time, otherwise you actually start to damage the very things that are there. And this is the key person to the whole exercise. This is Sally Pendergast, our farm manager, who's looking after everything while we're away. And behind her are two of our other assets, which are pigs, which we use in the woodland at times to dig out the bracken. So inside the orchard there, I really hope some of you come over and have some time with us, because it is a very, very special place to be. Where we cut the hay, I'll be doing that when we get back in July. This often involves a lot of young people and fish and chips and beer to get the hay in, but you can really understand, and this is another sort of minor rant that you're going to get for 2 minutes, is about harvest festival and the need of marking the seasons. I don't know about you, but in our church, harvest festival became tins of baked beans and spaghetti because they didn't go off. Whereas for me, harvest festival is nothing to do about that. It's about the sense of well-being and relief and just sheer deep joy that there is enough in the barn for the winter. That's what harvest festival is about, is giving thanks that we've actually got food to eat. And at the end of it, we get these fantastic wildflowers. These are cowslips coming through, early purple orchids. And it's again, can be dangerous for the environmental movement just to see these as commodities. You know, we've got a tick list and we've got that one, rather than just a richness and, you know, part of the fantastic creation we have all around us. So that sort of energy, and others have described the beauty of all the different leaves that you get. This is cherry blossom around the orchards. But those orchards were just dying off. And they're, whilst they're incredibly valuable for some people, this is Rosemary Winnell and Will Watson, they're incredibly valuable for bugs and beasties and beetles. We have one very rare beetle in there, the noble chafer, who spends the whole year boring away eating boring wood. It gets out one day a year. It has to find its mate, do the business, and then die. And you kind of think, that's why you're rare. You know, couldn't you make it out for 2 days a year? Double your chances, but no. And, you know, you've just got to marvel at creation, that all these things have their little niches that just work, you know. So to keep that whole process going, we're actually planting lots and lots of young trees in order that they might die and produce more habitat for these beasties. But in the meantime, we're going to enjoy their fruit. Part of what we do at the farm as well is a process, we call it care farming. Social farming is about providing opportunities, in this case for adults with learning difficulties, to come and express themselves and help us with the planting. We're learning skills. This is a guy in the overalls, Nick, who runs a nursery, teaching us how to do grafting. Because again, many of the skills from the countryside have either been demeaned or lost or just gone. And my belief, which I'm probably pretty naive about, is that the folks that used to do things like this weren't PhDs, you know. They were ordinary folk, you know. So I'm an ordinary guy, can't we learn how to do this again? Likewise, come the harvest time, we pick the fruit. This is a group of guys who are recovering drug users and alcoholics. Getting out there, being in the fresh air, socialising, getting respect for themselves again. And in the process, we then press the fruit. We call it apple juice. I think you call it cider. We call cider the stuff you call hard cider. So I'm learning American as I go around as well. But great event. And fruit pressing, which we hope to do some when Sarah comes over in October. This is a group outside their church from Harvest Festival. We got them to all bring their apples. So we pressed their apples after the service, and they drank the apple juice and took it away home. That's now led into this young fellow. Peter has set up an apple juicing business in Bewdley. We've helped him get the kit together to do that. And he last year produced 10,000 bottles of juice. And this is all from stuff that would otherwise have just lain on the floor and gone to waste. This isn't apples that have had to be picked. This is all windfalls. Sharing the journey is really important to us, and the learning that goes from that. This is a group going around the forest and learning. We do a thing called a muir trek. We did it 2 or 3 weeks ago, where we go out from dawn to dusk, and there's a very simple, it's something you try on your own. You don't really set a route, you just go where you feel you want to go. Small group, very simple rule for the day, you don't talk about anything in the past or anything in the future. If you do talk, and the idea is you don't talk too much because you're sensing, you talk about the here and now, the smells, the sights, the sounds. But both Linda and I really firmly believe in just grabbing people and getting them to sit and listen and smell and be in this fantastic place. And for some of our groups that visit us, this is really quite a unique experience. This group of Asian women from inner city Birmingham, they're on a course learning English, so they came and saw us and bought some of our chickens. I wasn't intending to sell them, but they took them home with them. This young lad, he's blind, from a blind school in Hereford. First time he'd ever held a chicken. You know, and you just think, well, if you can enrich someone's life like that, they come and see the pigs, the cattle. This group came and dug a pond. They're from a church in Wolverhampton. Others come to learn how to cleave the wood. And because we've got plenty of space and plenty of stuff like wood around, it really doesn't matter if they mess up a bit, because we've got another piece of tree we can have a go with. We've had a go at charcoal making. Found it to be a very disgusting, dangerous, smelly, fumey business, so we won't do that again. But you have to marvel at the people who did it in the past. We're now going into the woodland management a lot more, and from the woods that the guild owns in and around the forest there, how do we make that process productive? And the responsibility and challenge I feel is when we're working with oak, the decisions that I and others make, we won't know whether we've got it right in our lifetime. You know, this is, I mean, growing oak trees is a bit like a vegetable garden. They're just big vegetables. But the decisions we take now will affect how the crop in 150 years' time. And in the meantime, we've got to earn some money doing it. So we're producing firewood, fencing and all the rest of it. Now, just want to briefly touch on one or two other aspects. One of the things that Linda's been very keen to do is to pick up on some of Ruskin's thoughts about getting to people to see. And so running courses for people learning to draw with charcoal in the forest, where they actually spend a lot of time just sitting and seeing, was where that got started. And we started to then think, well, we've got this little building. Not very good building at the moment, just got a low asbestos roof on. And around about the same sort of time, the guild came across these drawings that Ruskin had had commissioned from Joseph Southall of a museum to be built in the middle of the forest to house his collection. And so we started to think about this idea of a Ruskin studio actually in the middle of the forest, somewhere where people would come and reflect, would draw, would paint, would write maybe, and where we could hold training courses. So we had an existing building, we took the roof off it, and the idea was just to stick a nice new oak roof on the top. And I'm glad I've put these pictures in because they show some nice mortise and tenon joints for tin. So having felled some oak trees, we brought in this piece of equipment called an oak miser to actually chop the oak into planks and into beams. The beams then go off to a guy called Stephen Wall, to his workshop, and this is where the mortise and tenon joints come in. Stephen then, working to the drawings and with his own experience, constructs the joints, and what you get back is a sort of flat pack kit, really. It's sort of a big version of IKEA, I guess. But it's fantastic to see it coming together. It's basically medieval technology. And one of the challenges we've got with the Guild's Oak Woodland and the other woods around us is, can we do more structural stuff with oak other than this? I mean, this is good, and it's great fun, making these huge trusses, winching them into place. Tremendous number of, these are 6x3 oak beams for the roof trusses. In all, this little building took 50 oak trees. So when you get to some of the big cathedrals or big ships like HMS Victory, whole forests must have been needed. And so we've got loads and loads of oak. What can we do with it that is a better use of the material, really? As I say, this is medieval technology. It's beautiful. I think it passes most of those lamps, the seven lamps. Certainly people seem to love being in it. It's a lovely building to work in, and we hold meetings in there and training courses, spinning, basket making, anything that can get people to get their hands doing things again. So, learning point so far, it's been hard work. I really haven't got a clue how anyone really makes a living out of farming these days, because the pressure is all really on to screw the price down of what your food costs you. And it seems crazy that milk is cheaper than bottled water, you know, when you look at what's gone into it. Guild has been fantastic, and there's lots and lots of people around. It's all really worth it, especially in the spring. So what's next? And this is where I want some input and advice over the coming weeks and months, because St. George's Farm, our tenant there, who'd been living there since 1956, Jack Bishop, died about 8 weeks ago. And so we've now got the opportunity to really rethink and anchor, if we can, what was Ruskin's original ideas and views and vision for this land? What are the current things that make sense for us to do there? And ultimately, what does that word fruitfulness mean in that context? So this is the building. And the first thing we're doing is to just try and find out what on earth we've got. And this was a gathering about 2-3 Wednesdays ago of some of the top naturalists from the area. They look a pretty mean bunch, but they're actually, you've got some of the top ologists of every field there. They're quite weird, some of them. And you have people who go around with huge sweepy nets who are really into this tiny, 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 tiny little insect, and go whoopee when they found something they've never seen before. But it's all part of it, isn't it? So we're finding out what's there. The building itself's in very good condition. And we're then measuring up this field. This is Ellie, our forestry apprentice. We've got funding to replant that orchard of 177 fruit trees that were planted in 1880. Terribly easy just to go to William Graham's plan and say, well, we'll do exactly the same. But my mind tells me, no, some of those fruit trees, they weren't very good. They aren't the varieties people plant now because they didn't work. Also, half of the trees that were planted were plums. Now, how many people eat an awful lot of plum jam these days? Not so much. So we've got to think through the sort of slightly commercial consequence of what we plant there. So it's probably have a few more apples than it did before. We've also got these fantastic oak trees. So we're measuring each one that we've got in a piece of wood pasture there. We put that on a database. And what we want to try and be smart at is to link up with people who are making timber frame houses so that they can order the oak from the oak tree that's standing. They only want it as green oak, which is great. So rather than us felling the trees speculatively for the market, we'll fell them to the demand from the house builder. And the house builder will be able to say that we make our houses with English oak, whereas at the moment they use 90% French oak. So in the future we want them to use English oak, And the guild gets a better price for its oak. And we can sell a story about that as well. Sorry, I'm losing the plot here a bit. This is one of the guys swishing around with his net. But, I mean, isn't that... I don't know how you feel about that. To me, that is England, you know, looking through a grove of oak trees. And it's a little bit early. They're just starting to show in the front there the bluebells. And if we can graze this land carefully under the trees, we should get the wildflowers back that were there before in the 1960s. This was ploughed and reseeded. We've got another building like this. There's a big old barn here. We've got thoughts as what to do with that. Do we need space for more people to come and stay? Do we need workshops? Jim and I had a bit of a conversation last night about the wood school. Places where people can come and work in the forest. We've got this building, which is an old barn, where we're thinking of a sawmill to start adding value to this oak, where people can come and choose the oak they want for their whatever it is they're making, whether it's picture framers, cabinet makers. I just feel that if there's not somewhere, if we can't make it work here, where there's this fantastic story about Ruskin arts and crafts and all the rest of it, there's not a lot of hope. So that's just a sort of plan of the site. We're going to have restored grassland, orchard and wood pasture with some workshops, living spaces, perhaps an office. And the huge challenge for me is, well, where do these people come from that are going to make this work? So if you in your lives come across folks who want to explore that, then I think one of the things we've got to try and do is to look at a way in which we can have some internships or some training programs so that young cabinet makers, young people who are wanting to make their mark in the world have somewhere to come.
What about old ones?
And old ones. I meant young in their experience of being a cabinet maker, perhaps. No, it's right, slippery slope there. So it's got some sort of element of study going on there, sawmilling, and what we're calling a centre of excellence for woodland management and processing. In England, we have lost the skill of managing our own native woodlands. Since the First World War, we've basically planted Douglas fir and Corsican pine, lodgepole pine. So all our forestry teaching has been around softwoods. We're now running study visits to Hungary and France to learn how to manage our native woodlands. So somehow we've got to sort of recapture that. So this just leave you with this. This is the sort of last picture, really. This is an artist's impression of, the architect's impression of what that building could look like. This has five craft workshops on the ground floor and five living spaces above. Because again, when we start looking at doing apprenticeships, it's very difficult to find anywhere for young people, to live that they can afford out of what they might get in terms of their apprenticeship. So want to end by saying thank you so much for inviting me. Hope you found that interesting. The slides really don't do justice to all the different things that are going on there. So do come and see us. Thank you.